I'm Tass Mellis of The Starters.
This is Ben Golver with the Open Floor Podcast.
Hi, I'm Kristen Ludlow from NBA Inside Stuff.
I'm OG Anunoby of the Toronto Raptors.
Hey, I'm Elena Deladon, and welcome to the Double Clutch.
Double Clutch.
Double Clutch.
Double Clutch.
Double Clutch Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Double Clutch Podcast. I'm Nick Whitfield, one of your regular hosts. And today, I'm excited to be joined by Davide Chinellato, NBA editor for Gazzetta dello Sport in Italy. How are you doing, Davide?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Do you want to give our listeners a little idea of what your job is day to day, just so they get a feel for your experience and type of guys you've interviewed and that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. I've been an NBA editor here at Gazzetta since 2013. Obviously, La Gazzetta dello Sport is one of the biggest sports brands we have in Europe. I've been covering the NBA since 2007, obviously focusing a lot on the Italians at the beginning. We had Andrea Bargnani, Marco Bellinelli, who won the championship in 2014 with the Spurs. Danilo Gallinari is still playing in the Eastern Conference Finals with the Atlanta Hawks. But, you know, in Italy, the NBA is pretty popular, and we're not, our fans are not tied only to the Italian players, but they're fans of the league in general. So I've been covering Kobe, LeBron, all the biggest names in the last decade or so. I've been to the NBA Finals. I became the first non-US reporter to vote for the NBA Finals MVP award in 2016, and I'm still part of the media panel who votes for the NBA End of Season Awards and the NBA All-Star Starters.
And again, what a privilege it is to have you with us tonight. Before we, I'm going to talk to you about Kobe in particular a bit later, based on our prior time we were together. But first, I'm going to dive into this week in the NBA. Kirk, if you can cue up Around the Association, please. So this week in the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks have taken a 2-1 series lead versus the Atlanta Hawks. In Game 3, we saw a huge performance and fourth quarter specifically from Chris Middleton, who's taken a lot of flack through the playoffs. In a scary event for Hawks fans, despite still playing over 39 minutes and dropping 35 points, Trae Young rolled his ankle after stepping backwards onto a referee's foot and is now undergoing an MRI to test the severity of the injury. The Phoenix Suns are now up 3-1 versus the Clippers, with a chance that if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, that series could already be over by the time you hear this. But from the value game-winning dunk to the efficient 19 points and 22 rebounds he grabbed in Game 4, the continued development of DeAndre Ayton has been fascinating to watch. In what still counts as a New York Knicks postseason victory, four former New York Knicks were hired into new coaching positions. Jason Kidd is taking up the mantle in Dallas, Rick Carlisle in Indiana, Chauncey Billups in Portland, and Ime Udoka in Boston. Orlando Magic fans shouldn't feel left out of this nostalgia fest, however, with 90s icon and owner of one of the most underrated signature shoe lines, in my opinion, of all time, Penny Hardaway is interviewing for the vacant Orlando Magic job. On June 22nd, the NBA draft lottery took place to decide the top four picks in the upcoming 2021 NBA draft, with the top 10 now rounding out as Detroit, Houston, Cleveland, Toronto, Orlando, Oklahoma City, Golden State, Orlando again, Sacramento, and New Orleans. And finally, USA Basketball has named its roster for the Olympics, with only Jason Tatum and Chris Middleton returning from the squad that ultimately disappointed out in China at the FIBA Basketball World Cup. The rest of the squad is made up of Kevin Durant, Damian Lillard, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, Zach LaVine, Kevin Love, Draymond Green, Bam Adebayo, Drew Holiday, and Jeremy Grant. The last time the USA failed to take the Olympic gold was back in 2004, so the pressure is most definitely on for this more experienced and talent-laden roster to win it all in Tokyo. Coming back to you, Davide, is there anything that stood out from the past week as being super notable for you, either in the games or wider league news?
Well, you mentioned DeAndre Ayton, and I'm loving what he's doing in this playoffs. I remember when he first entered the league in 2018, he was a number one overall pick in a draft class that included Luka Doncic and Trae Young. And he was, you know, obviously overshadowed a little bit by, you know, Luka and Young, obviously emerging as the top two names in that class. But I guess Ayton in this playoff is proving to be one of the best, if not maybe even the best, the most consistent player for the Phoenix Suns. And the Suns are one game, one victory away from reaching their first NBA Finals since 1993. So I guess, you know, the way he dominated game four, 19 points, 22 boards, as you said, stood out a lot. I didn't expect him to become this type of player. As you said, Chris Paul is the best thing that happened to his career because he definitely helped him reach the next level. And I guess we are probably seeing the beginning of one of the future centers of the league. Obviously, this year is the year of the return of the centers with Nikola Jokic winning the MVP. Joel Embiid ended up second. And we've seen a lot of players showing up in this role that was once forgotten because of the three-point revolution made them, made them kind of, you know, not more useful to a team. But Ayton, with Jokic, with Embiid, I guess he's proving centers are useful. And he's not one of these modern centers, you know, he cannot shoot from three, he cannot be what Jokic does in terms of passing and leading the team, but he's definitely surprising a lot of people. And I'm looking forward to see him maybe helping the Suns reach the next level together with Booker and Chris Paul, obviously.
Yeah, and what I find interesting about Ayton is how he, through the way the Suns play and his experience in the NBA so far, as you say, he's not a modern center in the same way Jokic is, or even old school in terms of Embiid, who still gets a lot of touches in the post. What I like about DeAndre Ayton is how well he's accepted his role. And for a long time, I always wondered why no centers coming into the NBA looked at someone like Tyson Chandler and saw that as a real sort of blueprint for success in the NBA. Someone who can defend the rim, is going to set effective picks, roll, he's a super athlete, can switch defensively. And if you can do those relatively simple things as a center, you're going to be an effective big in the NBA.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but we're seeing more than just a decent center here. I guess we're seeing a future star. Obviously, Booker is a superstar of the Phoenix Suns, and Chris Paul is the guy who helped change the team and reach the next level. But Ayton in this playoffs is playing like he belongs. You know, he belongs to the star category. He's improving a lot, doing a lot of things. He's been a factor both on offense and on defense. He's making a difference in many, many things. His length, I guess, it's really helping the team. He's getting rebounds that nobody else on the Suns roster can really get. And, you know, he had to face Jokic in the second round. It's dual with Ivica Zubac in the last few games has been really, really good. But, you know, his consistency, the way he's showing his maturity and his growth, especially from the mental side, I still remember the player he was in the first 2 years. It was lazy, you know. It was probably not fit. And, you know, I think Devin Booker said this when Ayton first came into the league, it was never, you know, a gym rat or, mm-hmm. you know, a guy who watched a lot of films and study his opponents. He's taking it to the next level here, you know. Booker said he's now discussing with Ayton a lot about their next opponents or their previous games. And I guess this is a player who wants to get better and who wants to become something more than just, you know, your average rotation guy. And he's living up to the expectation of a first round pick. Maybe he will never be the best player in his draft class, but he's becoming a very good player. And I guess, you know, obviously when you pass on a generational talent like Luka Doncic, you're still upset, but, you know, the Suns got Ayton because he was a guy from Phoenix, and I guess he's living up to some sort of expectation.
If I can change direction a little bit, one thing I think might be interesting and quite funny for our listeners is to talk about the first time we met in person. We were on our way to China for the FIBA Basketball World Cup live draw, and our experience involved almost being deported from China, being interrogated for a long time, being stuck in Hong Kong for somewhere between 24 and 48 hours before eventually being escorted into China as VIPs and welcomed with open arms. What a surreal experience that was.
Yeah, definitely a surreal one. I've never been almost deported before. I remember vividly when you arrived at the Shenzhen airport, it kind of saved me and the French colleagues who lived this experience with us. And, you know, it was tough for a few hours when we were sent back to Hong Kong and we were told we were supposed to board on our first flights to our respective home countries. That was tough, you know, because I personally just had a 12-hour flight from Milan, and I guess you had the same from London. But yeah, lucky, you know, with the help of FIBA and the help of, you know, some friends, we managed to made it to Shenzhen. And, you know, that experience, you know, was unforgettable for a bunch of reasons, both from a working perspective and from a personal perspective. I guess when you go through something like that, it's like forever, I guess.
Absolutely. One of the positives from that trip was obviously getting to meet Kobe, and you've obviously interviewed him a number of times. And one thing I've always wondered, I always wanted to ask you, was his insistence on speaking Italian when you interviewed him. Two things. A, how good did you perceive his Italian to be? And B, do you think you got a different impression of Kobe Bryant? Was he more vulnerable speaking in Italian versus English, where he's so well media trained and just gives the stock answers? Do you feel like you got a different impression speaking to him in that language?
I mean, his Italian was pretty good, especially when you consider he lived in Italy for 6 years when he was a child and then moved back to the States. Obviously, his native language has always been English, and he's been married to Vanessa, who speaks Spanish. And, you know, at the end, when we met him in China, for example, his Italian was a little bit mixed with Spanish, but mm-hmm. it was still pretty great. And yes, I guess we had a different side of Kobe, because, you know, he felt Italian. And, you know, for us, for Italian fans, he was like the only NBA superstar who spoke Italian. And it was always great to talk to him in Italian, because he was always sincere, more open than I found it be when he spoke in English. And we get a different side of him, because, you know, you could feel that connection, because he was always talking about his time in Italy. So when he was a child, for example, you're showing images of an interview we had in Paris. And in that particular interview, he told me he was teaching his daughter Bianca to high five, singing her an old Italian song from a guy named Giovanotti. Was the title of that song was Give Me Five, and that song was pretty popular in the late 80s, early 90s, so when Kobe was there. So he always had this side of an NBA superstar you don't normally get unless you're pretty familiar with him.
One thing I'll always remember from that trip is seeing him not only do the interview with you in Italian, but also with our Spanish colleagues, insisting on speaking Spanish to them. And from what I understood, I don't speak any Spanish at all, really. His Spanish was not super good, but I think it really spoke to Kobe Bryant's character that speaking to global media, he was insisting on kind of mastering his craft of the language and speaking the native language of a foreign media who he was kind of literate at, which I really think that was an interesting observation to watch Kobe Bryant in that environment. And it kind of mirrored how he was as a basketball player.
Yeah, I guess he understood better than everybody else how global the reach of the NBA is. And he's probably the first global superstar after Michael Jordan, of course. But differently from Jordan, he came from a different background, you know. He grew up in Italy, you know, he married a Spanish sort of girl. And I always remember he spoke in Italian with Vujicic. And I remember listening to an interview with Paul Gasol in which Paul said that the first time he met Kobe, Kobe welcomed him in Spanish. And they often spoke Spanish on the court, and that helped Paul get acclimated with the Lakers and, you know, gel together sooner with Kobe. And I guess, you know, it was a mix of being raised in a different way, being in contact with a foreign culture, because he went to school here in Italy. He did all the elementary school and part of the junior high. And also, you know, understanding from a global perspective how important it was for him to reach fans in many, many countries. When I remember reading this thing, when the Team USA went to the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, he was by far the most popular player on that team. And that team included LeBron James and many other NBA superstars. But Kobe was by far the most popular, with fans cheering for him in every place, in every city.
Yeah, I mean, having throughout both the live draw and during the tournament, having seen how Chinese fans react to Kobe's, or even the suggestion of Kobe Bryant's presence in a building anywhere, it was really a sight to behold. If we can move on a little bit, I want to ask you about Italians in the NBA and the state of Italian basketball in general. What is within the country? What's the feeling in terms of Gallinari, obviously still playing well in the playoffs right now? Is it a feeling that Italian basketball is growing and improving currently?
Actually, to be honest with you, I think Italian basketball is going through a process of changing of generation. You know, Gallo's 33. Bellinelli just came back to the Italian league after 13 years in the league. He's 35. We have some guys of that generation closing to the end of their careers. Gigi Datome, the captain of the national team, is another one. He played 2 years in the NBA, and he played for Fenerbahce in the EuroLeague for 4 years before returning to the Italian league this year. So there is kind of a change. We have some interesting youngsters coming up. Nico Mannion, playing for the Golden State Warriors, is going to be the starting point guard for the Italian national team in the pre-Olympic tournament this week in Belgrade. We have a couple of other youngsters. Paolo Banchero, who is projected to be the number one or number two overall pick in the 2022 draft, is going to be another, you know, youngster, even if he grew up in Seattle and you know, he's American born but Italian at heart. So I guess there's a change in the generation. We still have pretty good players, but we're trying to find out new stars who can replace Gallo in the league, who can replace Bellinelli in the league. It's going to take some time probably, but we have Eurobasketball next year in Milan. We have one of the groups here. So I guess, you know, the Italian league is trying to rejuvenate itself, trying to make up, you know, in the 80s, the Italian league was probably the best league outside of the NBA, and Olimpia Milano was dominating the European competitions. Since then, we had the slow decline. And right now, I guess we still need like Italian superstars people can really fall in love with to be back to that level. Obviously, you know, nowadays compared to the 80s, the best players go to the NBA and become NBA stars. We need that. We need to have some young players who become an NBA star or superstar. And we need that. But at the same time, we have Olimpia Milano reached the EuroLeague Final Four this year for the first time in 29 years. Virtus Bologna is another powerhouse, historic powerhouse. Won the Italian League this year. And there's an idea for them to get back to the EuroLeague. So, you know, we're trying to get back to where we were in the 80s and 90s. And about the Italian players, obviously, they are, for the NBA fans, they are, you know, their entry point to the league. But, you know, Gallo is a sixth man with the Hawks. Melli, who played for the Pelicans and the Mavs this season, didn't really play that much. Mannion, obviously, as a rookie with the Warriors, being a point guard, didn't play that much. As I said at the beginning, Italian NBA fans are more intrigued by the NBA in general than mm-hmm. by the Italian players. But yeah, they can be the entry points to the league for many, I don't know, casual football fans who heard about the NBA and are looking for some Italian players to follow and then to fall in love with the league in general.
And two questions I'm going to link here. The first one is, do you think it's fair to say that from the start of his career to now and whenever it ends, Gallinari's probably had the most successful NBA career of any player? And linked to that, a question in the chat from Mike Millertime, one of our other regular hosts. How do Italians think of Andrea Bargnani?
Well, Bargnani obviously was the first overall pick in the 2006 draft. He was always perceived as a talented guy, lacking the motivation to become a superstar. Maybe, you know, being picked number one overall didn't help him. He got picked from the Raptors, who were probably the only teams who would have picked him that high. But at the same time, they got Chris Bosh as a franchise player, and they played in a similar role. So it was a bit of a tough transition. So the view for him is like a huge talent who never really reaches full potential, especially in the NBA. With Gallo, I think he was definitely the most talented player, Italian player who played in the NBA. He's been there since 2008. But if I have to think about the best career, I would still go with Bellinelli because he won the championship in 2014 with the Spurs. Obviously, he never had the same role Gallo had. Gallo was the star in Denver. Bellinelli was always a role player, shifting from starter to bench player. But, you know, his determination, his will to improve, his will to be the best version of himself, really helping carve for himself a great career and a successful one. And it's great to have him back here after, you know, 13 years in the league, after winning a championship, because he's not only for the Italian players, young players, he's not only an example, but he's a proof that you can make it even if you're not super talented. Obviously, Marco, in Italian league terms, is one of the best players we ever had. But if you compare with Gallo, from a talent point, Gallo is my pick. From a who had the best career, I would still go with Bellinelli.
And thinking about the national team again, you mentioned already Olympic qualifying about to be played in Belgrade. So for anyone listening who's not familiar with how teams qualify for the Olympics, a number of teams have already qualified through their participation and success in the FIBA Basel World Cup. And the remaining teams have to play in a number of qualifying tournaments. And the one in Belgrade features the Dominican Republic, the Philippines, Serbia, who are playing at home, Puerto Rico, Italy, and Senegal. That's got to be quite daunting, and only one of these teams will ultimately qualify for the Olympics. So how confident are Italian fans going into these games?
Not too much, because we have to beat Serbia in Belgrade. Senegal just got excluded from the tournament because of COVID. So Italy already is in the semifinals. Mm-hmm. But we always know we need to win in Belgrade against Serbia. And Serbia doesn't have Jokic or Bogdanovic, who's playing with Gallo with the Hawks, but it's still, you know, a formidable team with Milos Teodosic, who was the MVP of the Italian League Finals, and Boban Marjanovic, the center with the Dallas Mavericks. So it's going to be really tough, but it's something that in general it can be done. We had the pre-Olympic tournament in Turin, in Italy, in 2016, and we felt very confident back then, but we ended up losing the final game with Croatia, went to Rio. So yeah, we know it's going to be tough. We know it's probably going to be like one of the best accomplishments of this generation of players. But, you know, you still have to play games and you just don't know what it can happen. But if you ask a general fan, it's probably going to be like, there's no way we can win against Serbia and Belgrade.
I'm not surprised. That is a tough ask for any team. So if we can move on to the NBA more generally, I already mentioned in our kind of start section that there's been a number of coaching changes. So we have Chauncey Billups in Portland, Jason Kidd in Dallas, Rick Carlisle in Indiana, and Ime Udoka in Boston. Did any of those stand out to you either as surprising or as particularly strong hires for those teams?
Well, I'm surprised by what happened in Boston, and I'm talking about Danny Ainge being let go as team president and Brad Stevens being promoted in his place. Honestly, if I think about who was easier to replace between Ainge and Stevens, I would go with Ainge because Stevens, to me, is a great coach. And even if he had some troubles managing the locker room, I still think he was a real, you know, great resource for the Celtics. So I was really surprised by that decision and him leaving the coaching position. I think, you know, Udoka is going to be a first-time head coach. So I've heard a lot of great things about him, but we don't know how he is going to be as a first-time head coach. If I had to pick the best hiring, I'll go with Carlisle and Indiana. I think the Pacers can be a really good team. Last year with Nate Bjorgren, they had a number of problems. But I've always liked that roster. I think it's not close to reach its full potential. Obviously, you have Malcolm Brogdon, you have Sabonis, you have Turner, who is a very good defensive player, Caris LeVert, TJ Warren. I guess they have the pieces there. They just needed the guidance. And I guess Carlisle can be really a great coach for them. I'm pretty curious about Jason Kidd coaching Luka Doncic in Dallas. Dallas was probably already, you know, when Dallas was eliminated from the playoffs by the Clippers, I thought they were going through a tough summer because of Kristaps Porzingis. I'm not sure he's the perfect partner for Doncic anymore. Personally, I recommend the trade because he's far from reaching his full potential. And I guess this season something happened between the two of them, and I don't see the chemistry there. But, you know, firing the team president, having the head coach who resigned, having to hire, to go through the process of hire a new top executive and a new coach can be challenging. I'm pretty curious to see where that team is going in terms of who's going to be on the roster when the season starts next year. Obviously, Doncic will be there, will be the superstar. He has the potential to be the best European player ever. But, you know, you need to put a team around him. I guess this season proved that you can't win with a superstar, and he needs help. And I guess it's going to be a tough job to find the right pieces to put together around him.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on Carlisle. And one of the things I've always noted with him is there are some coaches in the NBA who are very much system-driven. And I'm thinking of people like Phil Jackson or Mike D'Antoni, who whichever team they go to, they want to fit whatever players they have into the system they know works and they're comfortable with. Then you have other coaches like Popovich, for example, who the Spurs evolved based on their personnel over the years. And I think the same is true of Carlisle, who has been incredibly successful at taking the talents of the players he has at his disposal and building successful systems around that. And I think that's going to be an incredibly good fit with the roster that the Pacers have. And it wouldn't surprise me if they were dramatically better next season. Obviously, they had a strong start this year and then dropped off. So I would be definitely looking for the Pacers to be a serious playoff team next year. I agree as well that Jason Kidd is an interesting one. He hasn't overly impressed me in his coaching career to date. And I saw a lot of talk this week about the importance of, and we saw it in Portland as well, matching a point guard coach with a kind of star point guard. And the interesting thing about that for me is Jason Kidd as a player couldn't have been further from how Luka Doncic plays. Obviously, both incredible players, but I'm interested how that works. And the other thing I'm interested in Dallas is Luka has been really a darling of the media and fans and all the rest of it. And now it seems like a lot of, until he signs that big contract, which seems like it may be inevitable, but it seems like he's having a huge influence now across the franchise in the front office, the coaching, personnel decisions. And I wonder if there's a backlash waiting to happen around Luka if the Mavericks don't start winning on a bigger scale and look more like contenders in the next couple of seasons. I could anticipate a backlash for Luka in the same way it happens with all of those stars who are kind of high usage guys like James Harden. There reaches a point where fans, and not just like fans of the team, but NBA fans in general, their opinion seems to shift a little bit. Do you think there's anything there?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's time for Luka to, you know, improve a little bit on a personal level, but more important on a team level. The Mavs in the past 2 years have been, you know, the team of the future with him, obviously, you know, since year one of him being in the league with, you know, that year with Dirk, and especially last year, I went to Dallas. You know, Gazzetta gives an award to the best European player of the year, and Luka won for us in 2019, and I was in Dallas in February of 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And I was impressed by how Carlisle was predicating patience while everybody else were like, okay, the Mavs are going to be great because Doncic is great. I guess, you know, this year was the right year to start winning, and they didn't go past the first round of the playoffs. So it's time to take the next step. I'm not sure we are there because of all that happened. You know, you have to start from scratch with a new coach, a new general manager, probably a lot of new players. But, you know, I guess it's going to be on Luka to take this team to the next level. And if he can't do that, even if he wins like MVP next season, but, you know, the team goes out in the first round of the playoffs, I think it's time for him to get some results, maybe get some win a playoff series or be the special player he was against the Clippers, but, you know, win a series and take this team to the second round and maybe have a deep playoff run. So, yeah, I think it's not going to happen in Dallas, I think. You know, when you have that type of player, he's always going to be like your star. But similar, as you say, it's similar to what happened with James Harden. At some point, you need to win if you want to be a real superstar in this league. And I guess Luka being, you know, next year is going to be his fourth year in the league. I know NBA fans usually forget about the resume outside the league, but this guy was winning when he was 18 with Real Madrid. It was the MVP of the EuroLeague, the MVP of the EuroLeague Final Four, the MVP of La Liga. He was in the All-European Tournament team. So, you know, it's time to take it to the next level. He has the talent to do that, but I guess next season is going to be very important, especially because it's going to be his last one on a rookie year. He's going to be a max player starting in 22-23. So you want to win. You want to start with the right foot. You want to, you know, show improvement from a team perspective and not just from your own perspective as a player.
One of the interesting hires for me was Chauncey Billups. For the first time in his career, we're hearing slight rumblings that Damian Lillard is at best questioning whether he's ever going to win in Portland, and at worst, maybe even on the inside, starting to weigh his options as to whether he may be better placed elsewhere in the long term. So a team under pressure to build a winning team, hiring a first-time head coach. Did that surprise you?
Yes, a lot. Honestly, I thought I think Mike D'Antoni was the easiest choice because of his resume and because, you know, he's one of the system coaches, as you said, but he's also flexible on the way he wants to play. I guess the last 2 years with the Rockets weren't only D'Antoni, you know. Darren Morey had a lot of say about the way the team played, and I was curious to find what Damian Lillard could do with a coach like Mike D'Antoni, who was another great point guard, even if not at NBA level, but he's one of the legend of the Italian league in the 80s, as we said before. Chauncey Billups, obviously, he had a great resume as a player. He's a proven winner. But, you know, this is a guy who wasn't really into coaching until probably last summer. And he did a great job with the Clippers, especially in helping Paul George and Kawhi Leonard be more point guards than, you know, playmakers than, you know, their role. But this is different, you know. You're expected to win in Portland because of Dame. You're expected to build a championship team from the start. And it's not immediate. We had a lot of examples of great players who weren't great coaches, and we're not, you know, it's not written in stone. It's not set in stone that Billups will be a great coach only because he was a great point guard. So I'm pretty curious there. Obviously, he has the charisma, I guess. Not sure it's the right piece in a team that is desperate to win. If Dallas needs to win, I guess Portland needs to win it even more because Dame is 30 plus now, and he's been through a lot of season, a lot of disappointing seasons. The Blazers never really took the next step, you know, in terms of being championship contender for sure. They were like, we are championship contenders if everything goes right, but you know, injuries and a lot of stuff never really went their way. So I'm curious here, and I guess it's more at stake than just one season. That's why I would have gone with D'Antoni, who was definitely the more conservative choice, you know, a proven winner, a coach who has a, who can, you know, change a team like that. Billups is going to be, he has the potential to be everything, honestly. It can be like a successful story, but he also can be a failure. So I guess we'll see. And it's going to be a pretty important season for Portland.
And there's still a number of coaching jobs in the NBA that are vacant. We have Orlando, New Orleans, and the Wizards. Are you hearing any news about who might be in the running for those roles? Obviously, I mentioned Penny Hardaway has interviewed for the Magic, which currently coaching in college. Just for nostalgia reasons, I'd like that to happen. Are you hearing anyone else rumored? Is there anyone you think would be a good fit with those teams based on what we know as of today?
Well, I think the Magic can go for a first-time head coach because, you know, they're going to start a rebuilding project. And I guess Penny would be like the fan favorite for sure. But I wouldn't be surprised if they hire someone like Becky Hammon. You know, she's going to be the first woman head coach in league history if she got hired. And I guess she has the resume now, 7 season under Greg Popovich with the Spurs. She's only waiting for the right chance. And I guess she was one of the names mentioned for Portland. And I guess it would have been a mistake for the same reasons. I think Billups is a mistake, and I would have gone with D'Antoni. But with the Magic, you know, with a rebuilding project, she can be the right one, obviously, if Penny Hardaway says no. With New Orleans and the Wizards, I'm not hearing any rumors, but I think it's time for the Pelicans to hire a proven coach who can work with young players like Zion and Brandon Ingram. You need to build on those two. And I think Van Gundy was never the right choice for a bunch of reasons. His type of basketball was old when he got fired in Detroit. And he went with the Pelicans with the same ideas and the same mentality. And it didn't really work well. And with the Wizards, I was surprised to let Scott Brooks go. Not because I'm a big fan of Brooks, but because of his relationship with Russell Westbrook, of course. I'm curious to see who they're going to hire. I think Washington is another team who needs to win now. And by win, I mean making it to the playoffs, possibly past the first round. So I would have loved for them to get a coach like Carlisle, even if, you know, probably was never an option. But yeah, I think they both need the Wizards and the Pelicans some proven coaches, but I'm not sure they are out there. If Mike Budenholzer would be available, and you know, there's a lot of rumors about him being fired if the Bucks didn't reach the finals or didn't win a championship. If he somehow becomes available, he will be the perfect fit for both. If not, I don't see, maybe D'Antoni for the Wizards, but I'm not hearing this rumor. It's just a feeling. Maybe he can be the right one. But with the Pelicans, I'm not sure if I see the right coach out there. I think David Griffin needs to think outside the box a little bit and maybe make some of those surprising hirings to turn out to be the right one.
Yeah, I think the Pelicans have they haven't helped themselves with the roster they've built. It's quite an awkward roster, and how you build. And I think that was reflected in Van Gundy went down a number of options watching those games this season, where you had sets where Zion looked like he was the point guard. You had other sets where he was definitely the center and there's no other bigs on the floor. And it seemed like an awkward fit with Steven Adams on the floor. Brandon Ingram and Zion never looked to be super compatible for most of the season. So, yeah, I'm interested to see who they bring in there and if they either try and make all of those pieces fit or whether player movement is kind of first thing on the agenda when a new coach comes in.
Yeah, for sure. They need to find the right pieces. I think Zion and Ingram have a lot of work to do to, you know, improve and become the best young duo in the league. Zion really impressed me this season. When he played point guard, it was great to see. I think he has a lot of potential there to expand his game and be more than just a big guy. I think Ingram took a step back probably compared to the previous season when he won the Most Improved Player award. But yeah, the Pelicans need to find the right pieces to put with these two guys. I'm not sold on Lonzo, for example, as him being the third option. I think they made a mistake not trading him before the trade deadline. I think, you know, Bledsoe needs to go. Steven Adams probably needs to go. Josh Hart is a great player. But, you know, they made a lot of mistakes last season. At some point, they were complaining about lacking of, you know, shooters, and they traded J.J. Redick and Nelly, who, you know, didn't shot particularly well next season, but he is one of those big guys who can spread the floor and shoot from three. So I think they really made a lot of mistakes. And this is going to be year three for them with Zion. They didn't reach their goals in the previous two. So there's a lot at stake there. You're already starting to hear some rumors about Zion willing to go elsewhere. And, you know, they lost Anthony Davis 3 years ago, 2 years ago. They can't afford to lose Zion because they can't put together a winning team. So it's going to be a pretty important season for them too.
So moving on to the current games happening in the playoffs. Obviously, we saw Trae Young twist his ankle in the last game. Is that if he either can't play or is significantly reduced in effectiveness, do you think that's series over?
Yes, for sure. I think, you know, the Hawks were having a game until third quarter when Trae got injured. And the way they played in the fourth with him on the floor but not being 100%, the Bucks are a tough win even with Young 100%. If it's not 100%, I don't think the Hawks can beat the Bucks. I think the series is over and the Bucks can go to their first finals in years. It's going to be tough if he can't play or if he's not 100% because he was playing fantastically. I mean, this playoffs are his coming out party in the superstar. And I really love what Trae Young did. I was talking about him with Gallo the other week, and he told me, I expect him to be good because he was good in the regular season, but not this good. This is superstar. This is a guy who can take a team to the finals by himself, who can go to the Madison Square Garden and, you know, win a game, or, you know, can win a game in Philly playing unbelievable basketball.
As a Knicks fan, you don't need to remind me about those
games. I'm sorry about that, but yeah. Let's say he can go to Philly and win a game there. He can go to Milwaukee and win a game there and, you know, be the star. He can do so many things, shooting from Steph Curry distance, you know, attacking the rim and finish with a floater on or go to the free throw line. And what really impressed me in this playoffs is his ability to run the team. He didn't have this when the season started. It was like a selfish guy who was scoring 30 points and, you know, putting up a lot of numbers, but wasn't really managing the team. In the playoffs, I've seen him manage the team. That means being able to understand when it's time to finish and, you know, try to make a basket because your team needed. And when it's time to involve your teammates and go, for example, to Collins because he's better position, or to Herter because he's hot, or to Gallo because he's giving a lot of to the team. I guess this is what really separated Trae Young in this postseason and what makes this postseason his coming out party among stars. So I don't really see the Hawks. They are a deep team, but, you know, maybe if Bogdanović was 100%, if, you know, they didn't have DeAndre Hunter out, maybe they had a chance even with Young not 100%. But if it's not 100%, I'm afraid the series is over.
One of the interesting things I've found about Atlanta this season is they strike me as representative of something I've noticed with other teams, where if you are not a talented enough roster to realistically compete in the NBA, your best chance of winning the way basketball is played now is if you can have an elite point guard who is a dual threat in terms of their playmaking and their scoring. We saw it with James Harden in Houston. We see it with Luka Doncic in Dallas and Trae Young in Atlanta. That seems to be the best route to winning in the NBA now, if you are not one of the most talented teams, if you're not Brooklyn, say, and you have that kind of superstar talent on your team throughout the roster.
Yes, I mean, we're still in the point guard era. So if you have a really good point guard and you can build the right, you can put the right pieces together around this guy, then you have a chance. Then, of course, this year was a really weird season with, you know, injuries, COVID, pretty compact schedule with a lot of games and a few rest days. I think this is a start of a new era in terms of, you know, superstars, young stars coming to stardom, like Young, Booker, for example, and, you know, new teams, because whoever wins this one is going to be its first championship in at least 50 years. So it can be something new, but at the same time, I'm pretty curious to find out what happens next season, because next season is hopefully going to be normal, you know, from mid-October to mid-April and then the playoffs and, you know, more rest, more, less injuries, let's hope. So this can be the start of something new, and it's pretty fun to watch his playoffs because you never really know what is going to happen.
Moving on to Milwaukee, I have two questions that I'm actually going to link together here. So Chris Middleton, he's had a lot of criticism, probably throughout his career, actually, in terms of is he a number one, is he a number two, is he a number three player? And for him, my question is, are the critics wrong? Has he played well enough this postseason to go against his critics? And linked to that, I'm going to talk about Giannis, and he's had a lot of criticism during the playoffs for, despite putting up monster numbers throughout the playoffs, we've seen criticism of his offensive game in terms of how easy it is, in theory, to stop him in the half court. If you build the wall and he can't just drive by someone, is it too easy to stop him? So Chris Middleton, are the critics wrong? And Giannis, are the critics right?
Well, I think the truth is in the middle, as we say here in Italy. I think Chris Middleton wasn't playing that well in this series with the Hawks until game three, where he proved he can be a superstar. But he has never been consistent as a star, you know. He can do a lot of different things on the floor. He's a good defender. He can pass, he can rebound, he can score. But, you know, game three was the first game in which he had a really complete game. And he started this postseason pretty well, you know, with a winning basket against the Miami Heat in game one. Then he had some up and downs, and, you know, he wasn't playing well in this series. I think he needs to improve in terms of consistency to be considered as good as Giannis, for example, or as good as a top 20 player in the NBA. But, you know, playoffs is where legends are built, you know, and if you play like game three, you have a good chance to build up your name and, you know, be more respected and, you know, hear less critics. And about Giannis, I think he's one of the rare cases in which you have an MVP with still a lot of room to improve, because, you know, he's comparable to Ben Simmons in terms of he's a star with limits and he knows that. And differently to Ben Simmons, he's working on those limits to be a best version of himself, even if he's already won two MVPs, even if in these 8 years in the league, he improved dramatically from where he started to where he is now. But he's 26 and he still has a lot of room to grow. If he can put up a reliable three-point shot, he's going to be unstoppable. If he can start shooting free throws better than 55% or whatever his percentage is right now, he can be unstoppable. There are games in which he plays and it's really, there's no way you can stop, even if you build a wall. And there are other games in which it's set. I think, you know, what I really didn't like in the series against the Nets is when it was forcing from the three-point shot. And I remember hearing a Zoom call after the game, and it was like, yeah, I trust my instincts. Well, I guess you need to get, you know, your instincts right or better, because you can take like eight shots from downtown and hit just one. But, you know, in this series with Hawks, I've seen him attacking the rim and, you know, really understanding how he can make the difference, making the right reads, and try to take advantage of what the defense kid concedes to him. So I think there's a lot of improvement. Critics are maybe right in, you know, telling that Giannis is limited, but he's working on that. And I guess he can still be much better than he is right now. And, you know, he has a chance to be the face of the league for a very long time. I think we are spoiled a little bit because LeBron James in the past 15 years has been like, you know, unstoppable and probably, but that is not normal. I mean, LeBron is not normal. What Giannis is going through is more normal, you know, improving, getting better, coming to, you know, the best version of yourself and then having a final part of your career.
Interestingly, it's often credited in the NBA with the strategy of building the wall on Giannis, but I think we saw it definitely in the FIBA Basketball World Cup, where the rules around zone defenses are a lot more lenient, and you can literally create a permanent wall from stopping someone getting to the hoop. So yeah, that's interesting. Moving series, I have two questions for you in the Phoenix Clippers. And bear in mind, we have Ross in the chat, who's arguably the biggest Suns fan in our country. How far, you talked about players making their name in the playoffs. How far do you think Devin Booker has gone to making his name in these playoffs?
Well, I think you can count him among the top 15 players, 20 players in the league right now. He's always been a scorer. And you probably heard about, you know, the legendary shoe that Kobe gave him when they met in 2016. I guess he's living up to that expectations. These are his first playoffs, and he's playing great. I mean, he's one of the reasons with Chris Paul why the Suns are one win away from reaching the NBA Finals. And I think, you know, obviously he broke his nose in game one, and he was bothered by the mask in the past two games. But I guess it's going through a lot in terms of, you know, being the star and being asked to be the star. And he hasn't disappointed, and he's proven he's special, you know. He's another one of those guys who really benefited from having Chris Paul, having, you know, such a formidable example you can learn from, and really, you know, stealing the tricks of being a superstar from one of the best, definitely the best point, one of the best point guards ever, and one of the best players, a future Hall of Famer. So I think Chris Paul is what he needed, and it's now time for him to be counted among the stars. He's always been a fringe star, you know, fringe all-star, fringe good player. I guess you can take that fringe away and, you know, just consider him a star, a pretty good player, a franchise player. And again, this is only the beginning for him. I think he can only get better from here. And what was the other question again?
So on the other side, so for the Clippers, one of the weirdest things has been watching Reggie Jackson play, who looks like an entirely different player. As per Synergy, he shot an effective field goal percentage of 71% spotting up, 58% going one-on-one, and 58% in the pick and roll so far in these playoffs. He's an unrestricted free agent coming this offseason. Is this one of the best postseason contract year campaigns you've seen in a little while?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, no, I think not even Reggie Jackson expected him to be this good. I think, you know, I've listened to him discussing how much the Clippers and the trust he feels in the Clippers were to him helping be, you know, this good. But honestly, I didn't expect him to make the difference in a playoff game. Like, and he's doing this consistently, even before Kawhi went out. I think he's going to make a lot of money next season, unless he decided to stay with the Clippers, which, you know, he can still do if the Clippers were so key for him in reaching this potential. But yeah, I think a lot has changed for him, and, you know, he's one of those players making a name for himself in this playoffs.
Okay, and I'm going to move on to the less serious part of this podcast, which, if you can cue me up, Kirk, can we get a sound drop?
But Nick's silly nonsense.
Okay, so this is, I think, the longest silly nonsense question that I've ever asked anyone, so please bear with me. Okay. I'm passionate about this topic, you'll see. Love Island is set to start tonight, which, as of the time we record this, I think we're actually competing with it as it's on TV. It's set to start tonight, which, if you're not familiar, is an incredibly popular TV dating show where tens of beautiful people in their 20s are whisked off to an island. They live in a villa together in which they date each other, shun the concept of clothing, and welcome the ever-wise, reasoned, and intelligent debate and judgment of the nation on social media in regards to their appearance, character, and general worth as a human being. What could go wrong? Upon leaving the show, they will embrace a lifestyle of accepting money to appear in front of students and the inebriated at cultural hotspots such as Guildford, Surrey's Casino Nightclub. They will then promote Boohoo.com on Instagram as though their very life depended on it. They will initially describe this activity as part of their brand, thinking it to somehow be unique to them personally. As doubts creep in, however, they will inevitably start to question whether they are essentially just a younger and more beautiful Matt Hancock, before an existential crisis erupts and they wonder whether the desperate chase of fame was really worth it at all. Oscar Wilde perhaps said it best when, in The Picture of Dorian Gray, he wrote, "There is only one thing in life worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about." My question to you: if you could choose any current or former basketball player to follow in the footsteps of GB international Ovi Soko and appear on Love Island, the dating show, who would you choose and why? And to make your life easier, I'm going to pick first. I pick Chris Humphries because I think he had a terrible time on the Kardashian show and he deserves a chance at redemption and to have a successful TV dating career. Is there anyone that jumps out at you, past or present?
It's a tough question. I mean, I think your answer was pretty great. I still remember Chris Humphries, and I heard some rumors about him being picked as the replacement of Gallo. At some point, Gallo was approached by the Kardashians to be into that show. He politely declined, and Chris Humphries ended up being the chosen one. Honestly, I don't know. I think, you know, I think Lamarado already went there and he didn't end up well. So I guess I don't know. I think, you know, it's complicated because, you know, I've never been into that type of things. So I'm trying to think who's, I read the Westbrook name. Maybe, I don't know, because of his fashion and, you know, is willing to be popular for other reasons than basketball. Maybe it can be a good choice, but I'm not sure it's gonna. I mean, you know, Westbrook has two different personalities, right? One on the court and one off the court. If it's the Westbrook on the court, it's going to be complicated for him to be part of that type of show because of his competitiveness, and, you know, it's going to be really weird. It would be really weird to see him there. I don't know. Maybe. Thinking about the social aspect, maybe Kevin Durant, you know, it can be, nice. He can be a good competitor. You know, thinking about all the times he's going to, you know, have one of those Twitter rants that made him as famous as his talent on the court. Maybe I'll go with KD.
Yeah, I wish I'd thought of KD. Actually, good choice. Okay, so we have a Discord server. Please join if you're listening or watching and you're not already a part of it. Talking on D, we talk about some of the topics that people have been chatting about. This week we had people talking about the best sneakers to play in, Worcester withdrawing from the BBL, our domestic league, the best basketball books to catch up on. So, yeah, do join our Discord server if you're not already a part of it. And within Discord, we had some questions for you. Number one is, what are the best Italian phrases and shouts used when watching basketball games?
Tira, which is shoot. Passi, which is traveling. And some other words I can really translate or repeat about referees.
That was from Hoopin and Lootin, Elliot, from Mike Miller. What's the crossover like between the Italian league fandom and NBA fandom? Are there any things the UK could or should learn from Italy to grow both the NBA fan base and the domestic league? And to just to provide some context there, one thing we notice in our country, which is quite strange, is the fan base for the domestic league and the NBA don't always cross over as much as you'd expect them to. Is that true in Italy, or is it more in sync?
It is true also here. We have a tradition here where, you know, when the NBA wasn't popular in the 80s and, you know, the Italian league was at its best. So right now we have around 10 million basketball fans in a population of 60 million. And for every Italian league fan, there are three NBA fans. And usually if you're a fan of the Italian league, you don't like the NBA. And it's more or less vice versa. It's like, to me, they are two different sports. Even if it's still basketball, they are two different sports. And it's not easy, you know, to have some mix. But I can understand a lot of youngsters falling in love with the NBA. And then, you know, their best chance to see basketball live is going to see the Italian league in their hometowns, probably. So I'm not sure that is changing, but you know, I'm a millennial, so I can definitely tell you that for us, it's you're either an NBA fan or an Italian league fan.
Awesome. And we're running slightly over time. So I noticed you've published a book about LeBron James. Do you want to briefly tell our listeners what angle you've taken with that?
Well, yeah, it's a bio about LeBron James, and I try to analyze the different aspects of LeBron. First of all, his life as a kid in Akron and helping the readers understand what I'm a kid from Akron means, you know, growing up in poverty and always being, you know, in trouble with, you know, being brought up by a single mom and being poor, being African-American. Then, of course, it's, you know, the come to the realization of his NBA dream, you know, he became like arguably one of the best players in the history of the game. We can discuss for hours if it's better than Jordan or if it's not, but I'm also focusing on the more than an athlete aspect. I want the readers to understand that LeBron is much more than the most famous basketball player of his generation. He's a philanthropist, he's a political activist, he's a movie star, maybe. Space Jam coming out pretty soon. But yeah, it's many things, many, many things. It's not just a basketball player. So this is thank you for showing it. It's obviously it's in Italian, so I'm not sure how many of your listeners can read Italian, but yeah, I think I wanted the fans to have a full perspective of who LeBron is. And I want this to be a book, not just for basketball fans, but even, you know, for people who are looking for a good story to read and, you know, for understanding better our era and who are the icons people are taking inspiration from.
And where can our listeners find you on social media?
Yeah, thank you very much.
What's your handle on Twitter?
It's D Chinellato, as you can show. It's DCHINELLATO.
Awesome. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. And thank you also to Swede Amelia, who's followed us on Twitch since we started the call. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our Twitch channel for free if you have Amazon Prime. So please do that. Thank you to Davide for joining us tonight. And thank you to Kirk, as always, for making the magic happen behind the scenes. Thank you and good evening.